Alaska's immigrant population is growing faster, at a faster rate than almost any other place in the nation. And most of the people who arrive in the state are of working age. Immigrants are starting new businesses, paying taxes, and helping build our local economies. I'm Ann Hillman. Today on Talk of Alaska, we'll talk about the contributions of foreign-born Alaskans and the challenges they face when starting a life here.
Today's program is underwritten in part by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network.
The University of Alaska Southeast specializes in you. UAS is a learning community where your professors or mentors and friends on campus and online. UAS.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast. Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to slow down and take care with any cleaning, fueling, or painting products while maintaining your boat this summer. Be smart to save money and protect our marine environment and our beautiful ocean and coastline. Let's keep the water clean and keep our fish healthy. For more information, go to alaskacleanharbors.org. This message is sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Nearly 56,000 Alaskans were born abroad, but most now have homes, families, and businesses here in Alaska. A new report shows that immigration is having a positive impact on the state and its workforce. Today, we'll talk about the role of immigration in our local economy and what can be done to help our entrepreneurs. My guests today are John Bittner, he's the Vice President of Anchorage Economic Development Corporation, and Jessica Rowley, who is the owner of Med Physicals Plus. Thank you both very much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have you immigrated to Alaska from another country? Do you shop at or work for immigrant-owned businesses? Let us know by calling 1-800-478-TALK or 550-8422. You can also email us at talk@alaskapublic.org. So thank you again both very much for being here. John, let's take a quick look at a few numbers. How quickly is the immigrant population growing in Alaska and here in Anchorage?
It's growing in the double digits percentage-wise. It's actually pretty impressive. And this is part of a larger trend that we're seeing, moving away from what are called gateway cities like L.A., New York, that are sort of thought of as a landing pad for new arrivals to the U.S. And these immigrants are actually moving into communities like ours or communities in the Midwest, partly due to quality of life issues and partly due to attraction programs in these states or in particular cities.
So I've looked at some of the statewide numbers that show that the immigration population here in Alaska as a whole is growing at like, it was 19% over the
right.
4 years. In the country, it's much lower. It's more like 5%. Is that true specifically for Anchorage as well, or is that a larger trend statewide but not necessarily in the main cities?
It's actually in a variety of cities. If you look at the visa data, you can see visa applications are up in Fairbanks and Ketchikan and places like that across a wide variety of industries. Some of these industries, especially the ones that have the highest rates of foreign-born employees, we don't have a lot in Anchorage. So the seafood industry comes to mind. I mean, there are a lot of folks in the foreign-born industry that are in that field. Across the board, both in Anchorage and statewide, we're seeing an increase in numbers. Now, one of the things we should mention is, as with all numbers to do with Alaska, we have a very small population size. So the change is not tens of thousands of people. We're talking thousands of people, but still, it's a significant increase.
Okay. And Jessica, as we were talking, and he mentioned seafood industry and whatnot, you started nodding. Tell me what you're thinking here.
Well, that's basically how my family got here. My father actually immigrated to join my grandmother in Virginia. My grandfather was in the Navy, so they were in Norfolk. And my dad, this is actually a funny story, my dad read about Alaska. This is before internet and really a lot of articles about Alaska.
And was this like the 1980s or?
Yeah, in the 80s, definitely. Okay. And he and his friend, because my mom and my siblings were still in Manila, he decided that he heard about Kodiak, that he should go there. So they arrived here at about 10 o'clock in the evening from Virginia, got into a cab and said, "Kodiak, please." And, you know, they really didn't do the research. And so they got to Kodiak. I think they were on the last flight. And really, it really was. And I'm surprised, 'cause if you meet my dad, he's just very your typical shy, quiet, you know, Filipino gentleman. And to think that he went on to this adventure is just incredible, even to us, his family members. So they get to Kodiak, don't know anyone. And they went into a phone book, I think, by the airport, and just, I don't know what he was thinking, but just instinct made him look for his own family name and found one and called that number and said, "Hello, my name is," and just went to the family tree, and somehow they found a connection and they were invited to stay. And that was our beginning. You know, he stayed there for, I don't know, 10 years before we joined him here. And my mom, when it was time for her to join him, said, "I'm not going to Kodiak."
You know, well, kind of,
even though she's not been there. I mean, she's from Manila. She's a city gal, and she's a teacher. So I'm sure she did a little bit more research than my dad. And she says, "If I'm going to join you in Alaska, we're going to Anchorage." And so that's kind of how we began our life in Anchorage. So I've never been to Kodiak, but you know, met the family of the people that he stayed with, and thanked them for the rest of the family.
So when he got to Kodiak, did he end up working in the siphon processing business?
Oh, definitely. I mean, it was back in the day, I guess it was the only thing that you do really in Kodiak. And for someone who, I think he stayed in Virginia for about a year or two and just wasn't satisfied with the income that he was getting there. And and of course, without a family, he had nothing but time. So with that family here. So Kodiak fit the bill. He can work as many hours as he needed to and made enough money to send us all to college. And, you know, when it was time to join him, we're, you know, I'm glad we didn't go to Kodiak. I'm sure they're lovely there. But, yeah, it would be a shocker. It was a shocker anyway. From Manila to Anchorage, but
oh yeah, because Manila is huge.
It's huge. So when I remember, and again, we also didn't do a whole lot of research, because I mean, I was 20, my next sibling is 19, 18, and I think my younger brother was maybe 15, and I don't know. We were thinking we were going to the U.S. of A. You know, as the plane was landing, we're going, "Whoa, you know, what is this place?" And when we started driving around, it was April, so it's right after breakup. So coming from, you know, really shiny cars with, you know, even Manila is even the Philippines is a third world country. Manila has probably one of the highest per capita of Mercedes-Benz and, you know, all those. So here's all these caked with mud cars. You know, two-story buildings, and I said, they don't like colors because the buildings are gray, beige, or brown. And, you know, I had that sinking feeling like, oh, my God, where are we?
So what made you decide to stay then?
Well, really, I mean, in the mind of a 20-year-old, I was thinking 1 year.
That's how we get you.
Yeah.
almost everyone that comes here. It's just 1 year.
Yeah.
Is that true, like statistically? That
we don't have a lot of data, but okay. I mean, you hear it anecdotally often.
Exactly.
Like, you know, I said to myself, I would just come up here for a year, and then 30 years later, I'm still here for just one more year.
Yeah. I'm not going to deny that's my story. I was like, I'm coming up for 2 years, you know, work and roll. Found a person, stayed.
Yeah.
Done.
Yeah, exactly. And my family was here, but, you know, I was thinking back then I probably can convince them to leave. But then, you know, life happened, and shortly after that, I found a job that I did a lot of traveling.
And like around the state?
Around the country.
Oh.
And so I don't know when it happened, but I couldn't wait to get home. And then home, I realized, was Anchorage. So, I mean, it doesn't matter if I've gone to all these incredible places in the lower 48, I was happy to be home.
Well, I cannot wait to hear the next stage of your story, but let's go ahead and take a caller. We have Helen. Helen, welcome to the program.
Thank you for taking my call. One of the classes I took was immigration status in United States, part of U.S. history in mm-hmm. college mm-hmm. in UAF in 84. And what I've noticed is there's no much difference than the statistics I found. It's really hard for people who move here to comprehend how expensive it is to live in Alaska. It's like Costa Rica and Alaska have the same amount of high cost of living. And it's also hard for them to, you know, a lot of them don't have higher education, so what we need to do is teach them some more about English and getting together with their own ethnic group and help them, if they're Albanian or if they're Korean, to that ethnic group. And
you mean like help teach them about?
Much. We need to give them a lot of support because I'm sure we all immigrated here sometime or another, despite if we're natives. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So, John, please, if you could respond a little bit to what Helen said.
Sure. So this is actually an interesting perception that people have that when you have an increase in immigration in your state, you're increasing sort of the undereducated mm-hmm. population. Mm-hmm. And what we've seen is actually they fill both ends of the spectrum. If you look at and this data is a little anecdotal, but if you look at the number of doctors in Alaska, 1 in 10 were educated in a foreign university. And we use that as a sort of indicator that they're probably foreign-born. I mean, mm-hmm. it's not 100%, but it's mm-hmm. pretty close. So about 10% of our doctors, about 10% of our nurses, and 29% of sort of associated healthcare personnel. If you look at the STEM fields, immigrants blow it out of the water, especially when you consider the total number of them compared to the rest of the population. They represent mm-hmm. somewhere around 7 to 8% of the total Alaskan population, but somewhere north of 12% of our STEM fields employees. So what you see is you get a lot.
And STEM is?
Oh, sorry, science, technology, engineering, and math fields. So these are highly technical fields. Mm-hmm. If you look at the number of students who are foreign-born in our universities, a large number of them are seeking a master's or a PhD in STEM fields. I mean, mm-hmm. disproportionate to the population locally. You also see a higher amount of entrepreneurship in this demographic, and that's really fascinating. I mean, what you were talking about with your father, I mean, the kind of person that comes to another country, especially one who tries to take a cab to Kodiak from Anchorage, I mean, this is a guy that is not afraid to try things, to risk things, right? And that's sort of common among this demographic.
Right.
They are 2 times more likely to start businesses than native-born Americans.
Two times,
and that's based on the Kauffman Foundation study. And these businesses generate a huge amount of wealth. These aren't all, I mean, I'm sure we can all think of examples mm-hmm. of small businesses, but there are also 40% of Fortune 500 companies mm-hmm. are either founded or co-founded by an immigrant. I think over 50% of all the billion-dollar startups in 2015 were founded by immigrants.
Wow.
Yeah. These guys have a huge earning potential. Mm-hmm, they are highly educated, and they also, because they also, some of them fall into the demographic of the less skilled, they fill jobs that otherwise go unfilled. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you look at the number of healthcare jobs that we have that were advertised online, mm-hmm. it was over 12,000 jobs, I think. And mm-hmm. we have 538 people in the unemployment list that say that they are in that field.
Wow.
So it's not a displacement issue either. Mm-hmm. This is, mm-hmm. we are desperately in need of workforce, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. these folks bring really great skills. Mm-hmm.
And if you're out there listening and you're also seeking to fill workforce holes and looking to the immigrant population, give us a call. Tell us your story. You can call here in Anchorage at 550-8422 or outside of Anchorage. It's 1-800-478-8255-TALK. You can also email us at talkofalaska@alaskapublic.org. So, Jessica, you fall into a whole bunch of these categories. You're a business owner and your business is related to medicine. Tell me more.
Well, when I got to Anchorage, I was probably a semester short of graduating in the laboratory industry. It was 1988, and every other day there was in Manila some news about a coup that's about to happen, right? And when you're in that environment, you kind of shrug your shoulder and go, yeah, right. But with my parents being here, they were freaking out, right? So all of a sudden, a letter came and said something along the lines of, Dad's coming in 2 weeks. Prepare everything. He's coming to get y'all.
Because your mom was already here, too.
My mom joined him 2 years prior to us immigrating here. And, you know, what do kids with money and no parents do, right? I mean, we were having a good time. I mean, we missed them and all, but
I was gonna ask.
but the thing is, if you can imagine saying goodbye to everything that you know in 2 weeks, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, I understand. I mean, now that I'm a parent, I totally understand what they were, but they were also reacting as the world does to any news, you know, that is out there. So he came, and of course, you know, being the responsible kids that we were, we didn't have anything ready. So it took him another 2 weeks of leave for everything to, and so that's why we didn't have a whole lot mm-hmm. of research, even though my dad has been in Alaska by that time, I think at least a decade mm-hmm. by the time we joined him. So when I first got here, went back to UAA, and I think my professor, her name was Sharon O'Mara, kind of thought that, you know, I had to go to Math 101 and all that. And so I was miserable.
Wait, they forced you to go back to
it depends on, from what I understand, just a country, but 3.5 years of education was all elective credits. It was useless, basically. And so I had to go back, and I was willing to, you know, to go to the two-year program. Mm-hmm. And Sharon knew my story, and I think kind of felt bad for me. So she referred me to, at the time, Humana Hospital Laboratory. And I was hired there as a lab assistant and really never looked back. You know, decided, you know, I wasn't going to pursue school. I was going to take a break. But then, you know, life happens.
Mm-hmm. So you never went back and finished your degree at all?
Not in the laboratory.
Okay.
Went back to school 7 years ago and took my MBA, but
oh, cool.
This is after I've been in business for a while. Mm-hmm. So moonlighted and networked when I really didn't know what it was. Now, remember, I was 20. I never worked a day in my life, never drove, you know. So it was not only was it a shocker, you know, culture-wise. I remember my dad asking prior to being hired at Alaska Regional Humana, where do you want to work? Mm-hmm. And I said, I know how to write English. I know how to speak it, but I don't know. I realized very quickly that I didn't know conversational English.
Oh,
right?
It
was,
okay.
You know, the brain was just not working as fast as, you know, my mouth can express.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, I'm going to work at a restaurant. So my first job was at Denny's and Taco Bell. And at Denny's, I remember coming home and telling my dad, I said, these Americans are confused. And he says, why? He says, well, you know, I'm not in the door yet. And one coworker says, hey, what's up, Jess? And then the next guy says, what's coming down? And so I'm looking up or down and I'm thinking, what do you say to that? You know, and then realize, you know, slang was just not, I just didn't have a clue, you know. But they were very kind, and that's really, I think, the secret.
All right. Well, let's jump to another caller real quick.
Sure.
This is David up in Fairbanks. David, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
So I had a question regarding the, I think it was level of 15% of people in Alaska are migrant workers. Correct me if I'm wrong.
It depends on the field. I can sit here and I think, okay, so 10% immigrants are 10% of the employed population in the state. And there are 8% of the total population, but 10% of the employed population. So slightly disproportionately more employed. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I guess my question was, is that including migrant workers who come here and only work for a period of time?
Like J-1 visas and of that nature?
I guess I was wondering if that number is including people who just work here for, like, say, 6 months and then leave, or is that mostly just including people who work here and stay here and live here and become part of the community?
So the data that we're quoting comes from the New American Economy report that was released just recently, and they used the workforce data from the 2014 ACS one-year sample. I do believe...
That's the American Community Survey.
Sorry, yeah, done through the Census Institute. So that would not include J-1 visa holders, I don't believe, but J-1 visa holders are described in another portion of this report, and I'm just trying to find it. I apologize.
Those are numbers that are coming from census data, and census data is where people live. So J-1, I could be wrong, but I'm fairly sure J-1 is not included in that.
We do have H-1B and H-2B.
Yeah. Do you have other questions? Are you interested in other topics?
We have a really diverse population living here in Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen it, and it's just really great to hear that, you know, positivity that we're getting a much more diverse population here.
Yeah, I definitely agree.
Well, and the economic benefits that come along with that are pretty significant. They've shown nationwide that 1% increase in foreign-born STEM workers results in an increase in wages for native-born college degree holders. A fairly significant one.
Tell me more. Why? How is that?
Well, they tend to be innovative. They tend to produce more patents. They tend to be creative and create a lot of wealth in their economies.
And are we just talking kind of gross generalizations? I mean, their data is supporting the individuals going into these fields are doing different types of things.
Indeed, and I mean there is information out there that supports the fact that foreign-born STEM professionals, especially in the entrepreneurial field, generate a significant amount of wealth and a significant amount of economic activity.
Mm-hmm.
They've also shown that just immigration in general has a positive net impact, usually within 5 to 7 years on a community's economy. Wages rise, jobs become more plentiful. It's a good economic driver.
How? Tell me how that works.
A variety of ways. I mean, if you think about, you know, when people come into a community, I mean, they need housing, they need food, they need all these things. So that generates some impact. They create jobs through new businesses, twice as likely to create a new business. So those jobs increase the amount of available workforce. They usually provide labor in fields that are very difficult or expensive to hire for. So it brings down the overall cost of business. You're able to provide more services. I mean, just across the board, studies have shown again and again that if you increase immigration, you increase your economic activity and things get better in your community. Sometimes there's a short-term sort of transition period, a few years usually, but in the long term, almost across the board, everyone does well. The one demographic that there isn't quite as good a positive correlation, is for native-born workforce that have less than high school degree education. Okay. That does sometimes tend to be depressed, but in Alaska, our economic situation is a little different than nationally, so mm-hmm. we don't see that as much.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Another thing, Jessica, you were talking about how you got here and you had all of these credits from the university and they just didn't count. This happens a lot, doesn't it? That people who have incredible higher educations right. from other countries
right.
can't work in their fields. Have you seen that with...
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely. And I, as a matter of fact, my brother went back to the Philippines for a while for college. And I remember having a discussion with him on the phone saying, okay, either you get top grades over there so that you can compete here, or you come back and finish it here. Because otherwise, it's going to be tough for him. And I think that was when it was happening to me, I didn't know that that was something that was the norm, you know, almost mm-hmm. at the time. I don't know if that's changed, but
I didn't think so.
Especially, you know, and I understand in the medical field, you know, technologies are different. And although definitely sometimes, because I went to India, they're actually sometimes ahead of us. So it just, I think because the healthcare industry is, this is just me deducing that maybe it's because it's one of the most lawsuit-driven industry.
I mean, just anecdotally, like my best friend is from the Philippines and she yeah. almost completed her degree there and came here. And basically, like she was, you know, half a semester short of a degree and had to start over through mm-hmm. the UAA system.
Sure.
Because her credits didn't count.
That's right. And one of my best friends, she worked in the EKG department at UMANA at the time, was a doctor in mm-hmm. the Philippines, a general practitioner. And her, really her journey to becoming a doctor, now she's now a doctor in Tacoma, took her about 10 years and by way of going through the PA program, and then from the PA program working in the Aleutians, because mm-hmm. that was basically a guarantee for her to be admitted into the internship for the medicine, and that's 10 years after already spending all that time to be a doctor in the Philippines, you know. And I asked her, because I just spent time with her a few months ago, and I said, was it all worth it? And she said, yes, it was.
Huh.
So she's doing what she loves, and she mm-hmm. remained passionate about what she started to do. And she figured, she says, hey, I went a long ways. I didn't want to start over.
So. Yeah. And John, you keep nodding.
I wish they all had happy endings like that. I mean, sure. I really do. It's not just the healthcare industry. If mm-hmm. you look at the amount of certifications and other things that just don't translate well mm-hmm. over here, not because of any mm-hmm. difference in sure. standards necessarily, but just because we don't really have a mechanism to process them in an apples
right.
to apples
yeah,
way.
That's right.
We have and it's hard to measure that, right? I mean, but we do have a portion of the population that is underemployed. They're overeducated for the jobs they have, and trying to unlock that potential, especially now, mm-hmm. is mm-hmm. just crucial for mm-hmm. for smaller economies like ours.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So are there different ways to unlock that potential, or different projects happening to try to tap into that?
There are. I know that the municipality of Anchorage, this is one of the things they're really interested in, is identifying what kind of skill sets are out there. The mayor's office and some other organizations like Welcome Anchorage are really trying to identify, look, are you underemployed? Do you have skill sets that maybe aren't really being recognized because of a certification mm-hmm. or degree mm-hmm. issue? Mm-hmm. And then how do we integrate those people into the workforce in a way that meets standards here, mm-hmm. but also meets, you know, doesn't force them to try to get double doctorates. I mean, that's mm-hmm. insane. I mean, getting one doctorate is hard enough. I can't imagine having to do it twice.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I mean, just making sure that we recognize the work that's been put in, but also make sure that we cover our bases in terms of quality. And I think it's doable.
But I'm also curious, and neither of you may not have the answer to this, but so is it easier to transfer a degree from, like, England than it would be to transfer a degree from India? I mean, is there any sort of equivalency there? Like, or
I don't know.
I think that what you will find, and this is, don't quote me on this, but I think what you'll find is that Western, don't record me on this. Turn off the camera. What you'll find is that Western universities have closer ties. So they do have partnerships and things like that. Although in Alaska, we do have a sister cities initiative with universities in Russia and China and other areas. This is actually kind of interesting in terms of attracting foreign students. Mm-hmm. If you're in one of these cities and you apply to UAA, you can actually get resident status in terms of cost of education right off the bat.
Really?
But in terms of qualification of certifications and things, I suspect it's probably easier if you're from a Western university.
All right. And we are going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with more of your calls here on Talk of Alaska.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 directory for older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
You're listening to Talk of Alaska. I'm Ann Hillman. Today, we're talking about the impact of immigration on the local economy. Have you moved here from another country? How did you establish yourself? Let us know by calling 1-800-478-TALK or 550-8422. You can also email us at talk@alaskapublic.org. And we have a call right now from Alan in Bethel. Alan, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, how are you?
I'm okay.
Yes.
Oh, okay. I just want to say that I enjoyed hearing the other person's story, how she moved from the Philippines and moved to Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
I also want to say, well, I've never been anywhere outside the United States except to Mexico, but I'm part Filipino also and Yupik Eskimo. So I moved from Virginia as well, from to a village called Mountain Village.
Oh, wow.
When I was younger. Yeah, my dad was Filipino. My mom is Yupik Eskimo.
Mm-hmm.
My mom was going to school in Oregon.
Uh-huh.
My dad was in the Navy, so that's how they met.
Oh, nice. So
my older brother was born in Guam, and me and my sister were born in Hawaii.
Wow.
That's awesome.
Yeah, we've been everywhere. So the story was funny.
That
oh,
is
and
really
talking
funny.
About that, yes, I also have my degree in medical technology.
Oh, great.
And also a master's in public health.
Nice. Awesome. And and you're in Bethel now?
Yes. And I've been everywhere. I've even been to Kodiak.
Well, maybe this is a good moment to start jumping into the next part of Jessica's story, because she started working in a lab and now she owns her own business. Jessica,
so
how did that
happen? So basically, I had a call because I volunteered for the health fair, got a call from a lady who was doing paramedical business, and a paramedical company is basically health assessment examiners hired by the insurance company for people who apply for life, health, or disability insurance, or the inspectors to make sure that, you know, you weigh how much you say you weigh, and those kinds of things. And so it was just across the parking lot from the lab. So she said, why don't you work for me for a couple hours a day, and started with that. And
you basically just did, like, quick physicals on people.
That's right. Actually, I wasn't even supposed to do that. I was just supposed to answer the phone, but then she disappeared.
Oh.
And it was right around Desert Storm. And since we have a high population of military here, those who were getting their papers that they're getting deployed wanted to make sure that their family will be covered while they're gone. So the life insurance physicals were needed. And so I didn't know besides her, I didn't know who I was supposed to call. So when the phone rang, I answered it, and this voice on the phone said, "My name is, and I'm her boss. Who are you?" And I said, "Well, sir, I've been working for 2 weeks, and if I'm really not employed, you let me know. I'm going to be, you know, going to go across the parking lot again." And anyway, long story short is then she was fired. I was hired permanently, and that began my work for in the paramedical field. Mm-hmm. And so did that for the same company really for 25 years. And 5 years ago, I'm what you call a reluctant entrepreneur, because I really didn't want to. With immigrants, I think I don't think I'm an exception. Security, job security, is just very important. Okay, there's a little bit of status there too, you know. Wearing a lab coat, you know, is also a status symbol for some of us. Made us feel good, and so to even, because really they were a startup. I mean, I remember after being hired, when the mailman comes in to deliver my junk mail, because that's all that it was then, I would really make sure that I look busy, like I'm really rearranging my desk, you know, because really I'm just sitting in front of the phone most of the time. So my friends from the lab would visit me and look at, I have one desk, one chair, a fax machine, the thermal fax machine, and that's it. And really just a little bit of setup for, you know, the blood draws and EKGs and all that. But it wasn't glamorous at all like the lab would. And so they really thought I was crazy. And I, again, would say, it's a one-year plan, you know. And so so that's what happened. And then 25 years later, I remember calling my boss after a while and said, okay, you're paying me to do nothing. How do I make the phone ring? And he said, you have to make friends. And the reason for that he would say that, because he knew that I have this aversion to the word sales and marketing, right? And I looked at my picture from those times. I look really young. I look like I was in fourth grade. to even, you know, the idea of making friends, and sure enough, because I was thinking, well, I need to make friends.
So how did you do it? Like, how did you learn to network?
Well, he just told me exactly what to do. Go to this building, you know, give out your cards, introduce yourself, and tell them that we're the best thing since sliced bread, you know, basically. And I was very shy, you know, I mean, just like new immigrants. I mean, that was 1990. So I immigrated in April of 1988. So I probably have been driving by that time for 6 months. I don't know, something like that. Mm-hmm. And then my boss said, go call a real estate broker and find us an office. I mean, I haven't even looked for my own apartment back then. You know what I mean?
It was just
learning as, you know, very quickly. And I realized I really sucked at sales. You know, these making friends. I mean, then I realized I remember calling my boss and saying the reason that I decided to take the laboratory path is because I don't like to talk to people. I would rather deal with them in body parts, you know? So anyway, long story short, it was necessity. And then, of course, life happened. You know, just develop financial goals. Mm-hmm. And you know, you do things for additional income. And it flourished. Within the branch in Anchorage was doing not a whole lot. And so there, we're a satellite office of Seattle, mm-hmm. and by June of the next year, we were doing so well that they made Alaska its own branch.
Oh wow! So you obviously learned.
I learned, and I think it wasn't. It was more not through networking and sales, mm-hmm. but really word of mouth.
Okay.
And then, finding out the Achilles heel of my next competition, mm-hmm. which was he really just focused on the Metropolitan Anchorage and Fairbanks and Juneau and Kenai and Kodiak was all open. So I advertised the outlying areas, really have a process of how doing physicals there. If you can imagine recruiting in Bethel, when there probably would be 2 to 3 exams a year out there to convince someone, you know, to just take the job for a free lunch once in a while. You know, I guess I did well on that. Mm-hmm. Because I was, you know, I was just thinking I'm talking to a friend on the phone, like on the radio, I guess. Yeah. Anyway, so that's kind of how we got started.
Okay. And so you had to overcome some, it sounds like, personal challenges and then just learning to start a business. John, you mentioned at one point that AEDC recently received a grant that focuses on helping immigrants and people of color start their own businesses and kind of go through what Jessica went through. Tell me a little bit more about that grant and why you applied for it. And
I don't know if we can help you find people in Bethel willing to work for lunch, but other than that, I think this is actually a fun program. Her stories are so good. I just want to listen to her talk. We actually were invited down to LA by the Kresge Foundation, along with the Cook Inlet Housing Authority and the municipality.
And what is the Kresge Foundation?
The Kresge Foundation is a $2 billion philanthropic organization based out of Detroit. And basically, they've done a lot of amazing things, but their most recent accomplishment is after Detroit went bankrupt as a city, which is very unusual, they were the ones who stepped in and really led the charge to bring them back to solvency. And they brought us down along with representatives from 13 other cities to showcase, you know, what they had done, how they had done it, and to see if there was anything there that we could take back to our communities and implement to sort of, you know, either mm-hmm. prevent what happened to Detroit happening in our homes or to mitigate any kind of economic problems.
Although, just to pause.
Sure.
Are we worried about that sort of collapse in Anchorage,
no.
or we just
no,
needed
we are
to
not.
Diversify because it's healthier?
We're not worried. Okay. We are the reason you weren't selected based on, oh my goodness, you're about to become the next Detroit.
Okay.
Most of the representatives selected had some relationship to the Kresge Foundation. In
okay.
this case, Cook Inlet Housing Authority had received an Art Place grant from them, I believe. And so that's how they had that relationship, and they brought us down. And so we, at the end of the conference, they announced a grant opportunity just for the people that participated, and it was up to $30,000 to figure out how to implement something you learned about. And the one, we actually chose two, one of which was to model something after their Revolve Detroit program, which is you take immigrant entrepreneurs, minority entrepreneurs, and others at any stage pre-launch, so from concept all the way up to just about ready to launch, give them whatever tools or training they need to get to a launchable phase, and then you provide them with commercial space for 6 to 12 months at either free or deep discount so that they can, they're called pop-up businesses. They can pop up a store and start running a business, and it'll either succeed or fail within that time period, and it's very low barrier to entry.
Okay. So barriers to entry. Let's talk about that a little bit more.
Sure. So this is actually really interesting. There's a lot of them, not necessarily insurmountable, but one of the really interesting ones tends to be financing, right? There's a lot of different aspects of financing that either culturally or just because of the reality doesn't really work. If you look at and the immigrant community here and nationally has found really interesting ways around this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The Korean community tends to invest in themselves.
Yes.
I mean, they have these investment groups, which is really fascinating.
Incredible.
And, oh, I mean, they have a wonderful model. Like what they do is just amazing.
Like basically like microloans within smaller communities?
That's
yes.
Right.
And it's all based on sort of community reputation, right? So the failure rate is almost nil.
Nothing.
I mean, it's amazing. And each year, some of them are structured differently, but what we've heard is that they get together in these groups and everybody puts in every year and one person or, you know, family
they
gets it every
lots,
year.
Yeah. And say, okay, we all put in 10 grand, let's say, and there's 10 of them. So somebody would have that money and then they would pick names, and then if your name was picked, then your business would be the first one to get financed, and you have this many number of months to pay it off, and then once it's paid off, then the next person who draws that will then get the money, and it just kind of revolves.
And it's so cool.
It is so cool. Because I had to ask a friend of mine who owns an alteration shop. And I said, a Korean wonderful lady, said, because I was telling her about, you know, financing. And I said, it's just really hard. How do you guys do it? Because, you know, you all are very successful. And they said, we do it ourselves. There's no paperwork. No signature whatsoever. Mm-hmm. But I said, so, and she's been doing this for 30 years, I think. And I said, how many has defaulted? She said one. And that was because of an illness, you know, death mm-hmm. in the family and all that. It was something beyond his control. And just 100% trust. 100%.
Are any other communities that you know of doing this?
Not that particular mechanism, mm-hmm. uh-huh. but if you look at like Muslim communities, mm-hmm. they actually have problems religiously with interest-bearing loans. Mm-hmm. They can't mm-hmm. do it. And so outside of Alaska, and I don't know if anybody locally does this, but outside of Alaska, some banks have structured loan programs specifically for that demographic. Mm-hmm. But also the communities in areas that don't have that have gotten together, not quite in the mm-hmm. same way as the Korean community, mm-hmm. but very similarly where they provide those loans internally within the community.
So is there any plan to expand this model at all, or would it just not work without a community?
It's tough. I think during my MBA days, we went to India, which they have microloans there as well. Mm-hmm. Really, the big question was find out what they're doing and see if we can adapt it here. And the short answer is, not quite. And the reason for that is those factors that are, you know, like just the cultural, the trust. I mean, in those cultures, if you fail, if you let somebody down, it's not just your reputation, it's your family's reputation. The story behind, is it Mattel when they had the lead paint on their toys, you know, from China? Is that, yeah, you know, there's always repercussion, but that whoever that man or, you know, the people were, their family committed suicide because of just the sheer destruction, shame of their reputation. So in those communities, those are very important. That's why they I mean, 100%, it's awesome. But even in the Filipino community, that model will not work without. It's just a different mm-hmm. way of mm-hmm. Looking at things. But it's awesome.
And what's cool is, I mean, different communities have different solutions to this mm-hmm. problem. I mean, mm-hmm. there's no one-size-fits-all.
Right.
The trick
right.
is finding what works for that community, and they mm-hmm. tend to find it themselves.
That's
it's
right.
just sort of supporting
that's
that.
That's right, mm-hmm. that's right.
Because the Filipino community is, you know, wildly successful in a lot of ways.
Yes.
I mean, especially here in Alaska, they have an amazingly vibrant
mm-hmm.
community.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I want to go to another caller who's online. We have Martin from Fairbanks. Martin, welcome to the program.
Hi. I would just like to comment particularly about the healthcare system and, you know, the strong role that immigrants play in that here in our country. But on the other hand, I've had the opportunity to work in healthcare in a number of other countries, primarily in Africa over quite a few years. And, you know, we are a little bit notorious for making people in the medical field come here and have to start their education basically all over. There are a few programs that help accelerate it a little bit. In Europe, there are countries, England specifically comes to mind, where they bring African doctors up. And most African medical schools, they're modeled somewhat on, you know, European models, even though they don't have the resources. But the curricula and what have you are. And I work with physicians that have, you know, gone to Britain and then come back to their countries because Britain, you know, they have a training program, but they don't let you outstay your visa.
Mm-hmm.
But I would like to comment, there's been a lot written because so much of the world, even our country and European countries, have a shortage of general practitioners, family doctors, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Nurses as well.
Internists. Mm-hmm. There's a real brain drain, and a lot of, you know, the big danger is when you bring and attract medical people from these countries, they end up staying and they don't go back and help their poor countries and the people that, you know, really need their services because they're here, because it's attractive to them, and they get to practice, you know, in a high technology setting. Mm-hmm. But anyway, it's just it's kind of a conundrum, because I've just you know, the brain drain, particularly in Africa, has just been incredible. The number of trained healthcare people that are sucked up by developed countries and don't return, and I just.
Yeah, it's
know about that.
Eerily similar to what happens in rural Alaska as well, is that people leave their communities to get jobs elsewhere. John, you were...
Well, I mean, there's another side to this as well, though, which is immigrants tend to send money back to where they're from. That's, I mean, true. even if they bring their immediate family over, there is a really amazing transfer of wealth that goes on. So in places like Africa, where the local economy, I mean, it's very difficult to hold on to highly technical folks.
Africa's a continent, not a country.
I'm sorry.
I guess I just want to jump in there and note that there's a huge diversity of economies amongst that continent.
Absolutely. Sorry.
And just to remember, like, South Africa is nothing like Tanzania.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But in the countries within Africa that I think we're talking about, mm-hmm. that I think the caller was talking about, are the less developed countries. Mm-hmm. Exporting that brain drain is problematic, but not offering them job opportunities isn't going to solve that problem. Mm-hmm. I mean, really, what you need to do is fix the fundamental problems of the economy, and by pushing this money, which goes much farther there than it would here, back into their economies, I think it's a slower... It's a slower process, but mm-hmm. that's part of the solution.
Mm-hmm. And we are going to take another quick break and then come back to some more of your calls here on Talk of Alaska.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. The Arctic is wild, remote, and untouched. See how contemporary artists challenge the mythical ideal of the North in the Anchorage Museum exhibition, View from Up Here, the Arctic at the Center of the World, on view through October the 2nd. This message sponsored by the Anchorage Museum.
The University of Alaska Southeast specializes in you. UAS is a learning community where your professors or mentors and friends on campus and online. UAS.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're talking about immigration and the local economy, and we're going to bring on a caller. We have Roger from Anchorage on the line. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, you know, I'm listening to your program. It's all very happy talk about immigration. But I'm really a Trump supporter, and I'm pretty much a one-issue guy.
Okay.
I'm pretty much anti-immigration because, I don't know, I just was born in this country and, into its habits and ways and that kind of thing. So it really disturbs me to see it change so radically, so quickly.
And
so,
Roger,
really,
where are your ancestors from?
Ancestors? Well, I'm part Native, but I'm mostly, I mean, from all over. I'm kind of a mutt, but yeah, I mean, like, I'm one quarter Native from here, from Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, all over, actually. But, like, my ancestors fought in the Civil War and the American War, and so I'm like a patriot through and through.
Mm-hmm.
So that really kind of bugs me about the whole, you know, like, you guys talk about the economics of everything, and I don't know if I really buy that, because it doesn't really make sense to me.
Why?
Because you say, well, you know, I mean, Mr. Bittner, he says, like, oh, all these immigrations are wonderful, but we have a really good welfare program state, we should. But, I mean, what happens is that a lot of folks come here and they come explicitly for immigration benefits, you know.
That's actually,
welfare.
Yeah, that's actually not a true statement. It's a stereotype. And John, if you'd like to jump into this.
Yeah, I feel like I gotta.
Yeah.
Okay, so well, this is...
Well, I'd really more like to go to the cultural thing.
Well, but Roger, just one moment. I think it's important to note that it's not a true statement that people move here to get onto welfare. That's sort of a...
The studies show that they actually don't use our welfare program significantly and higher than native-born users, and they do have a disproportionate positive impact on the economy. They also pay a large portion of federal, state, and local taxes. So, again, this is one of those statements where people say it, but there's no data to back it up. I mean, you know, when I talk about the economic impacts of immigrants, I'm looking at the best data I can gather on this subject, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of people, when they counter it, they use anecdotal evidence from someone they talk to or something that they perceive to be true.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying that everything's positive. You know, like I mentioned, there are, you know, there can be negative impacts on some sections of the population. Mm-hmm. Usually it's short term, 5 to 7 years, you see gross positive impact across the board for native and non-native born citizens.
Mm-hmm.
But the cultural thing, I mean, let's go on to that if we
all right. And we
time.
Only just right. To warn you, we've only got about a minute left.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Well, yeah, I mean, like, for instance, you know, when I went to school, it was sort of a given that we had, you know, Christmas and Hanukkah, and we had a wonderful time. And nowadays, I mean,
most Jews are immigrants.
You really get in trouble for this stuff. Ooh. And it really, really bothers me. And I think people say, like, why they... You know, because like the Trump, like they try to figure out why is everyone voting for, or a lot of people voting for Trump, and they can't figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
I'm telling you about this is it.
All right, Roger, we have to roll out of the program now, but thank you for calling. I would like to note that a lot of Jewish individuals who practice Hanukkah are from immigrant families. My grandparents immigrated from Russia. But thank you very much for calling and for giving a different perspective. I do appreciate that. I appreciate all of the other callers we've also had on the program today. So this has been Talk of Alaska. My guests have been John Bittner, who is the vice president of the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation, and Jessica Rowley, who is the owner of a local business and an immigrant from the Philippines. Thank you all very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbaalaska.com. It's summer and time to get out on the water. Whether you're commercial fishing, heading to a weekend cabin, or tossing in a line to catch tonight's dinner, having a boat means regular maintenance projects, fueling, and cleaning. Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to minimize waste and pollution during these activities. Ask your harbor master for waste disposal information. Find more at alaskacleanharbors.org. This message sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program. Support for Alaska Public Media's Energy News Desk comes from Bettesworth North, Architects and Planners, and the Atwood Foundation. Support for Alaska Public Media's Energy News Desk comes from Bettesworth North, Architects and Planners, and the Atwood Foundation.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.